Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We appreciate you joining us today for another live edition of Midrats. And if you're with that esteemed cohort that is with us live, if you are so inclined, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you'll find a link to the chat room. And if you have some observations during the course of the show that you'd like to share, or if there's a question you would like for us to direct to our guests, that's a great place to put it. We'll be monitoring during the course of the show. And we always get a kick out of some of the comments the usual suspects leave there. If, however, you've got to run off and catch up on a few things at home, and you want to see what you may have missed from today's show, you can always get the full archive later at Blog Talk Radio, or you can take a shortcut and just subscribe to the free podcast over on iTunes or Stitcher. And today we're going to touch on a subject that we haven't dedicated a full show to, but we've touched on now and then during the course of the year. Because out there on the high seas, we have the rule of law that we assume that ourselves and others will actually play by. And oftentimes that doesn't happen for reasons either of malicious intent or national priorities seem to be more important than taking international norms close to heart. And the area we're going to focus on today is going to be in the South China Sea in China, and how we're looking at a new type of view towards the actions going on there that share in many ways, both inside their national traditions and also historically, a lot of the aspects of both insurgency and counterinsurgency on how actions are being taken and counteractions can be looked at to try to mitigate some of the things that are going on there. And our guest is returning to Midrats for the full hour to discuss this and a few other related issues is Hunter Stiers. Hunter is a fellow with the John B. Hattendorf Center for Maritime Historical Research at the U.S. Naval War College, and he works in a non-resident capacity with the Center for the New American Security. His work focuses on maritime strategy and logistics for forward-deployed naval forces in the Western Pacific in history and today. He's also a freelance contributor to the National Interest. And as a starting point for today's show, we're going to begin with the issues that he raised in his recently co-authored article with Dr. Patrick Cronin titled China is Waging a Maritime Insurgency in the South China Sea. It's time for the United States to counter it. And you can find a link to that article both on the show page and we'll put it in the chat room as well. And if you'd like to, you can always follow Hunter's latest musings over at Twitter at Hunter Stiers, H-U-N-T-E-R-S-T-I-R-E-S. And on that note, Hunter, welcome back to Midrats.
Sal, Eagle One, thank you so much for having me. It is such a pleasure to be back.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you again, Hunter. And I kind of nibbled around the edges during the intro because I wanted to give you an opportunity to outline for our listeners the exact definition and context of insurgency and counterinsurgency at sea for our discussions today, because it does mean a lot of things to a lot of people and it can be a very broad and complicated topic area. So but we really just want to narrow in on a specific challenge that we're seeing here. So if you could take a minute to define that for us.
Sure thing. So, as you said, insurgency and counterinsurgency, they can denote and refer to a lot of different scopes of activities and types of tactics and strategies A lot of the time when we think of the term insurgent, it's traditionally understood to denote a non-state actor. But if we really think about what is an insurgency writ large and, you know, at its core, an insurgency is a contest over who governs. And in the new work on these new strategic concepts of maritime insurgency and maritime counterinsurgency in the South China Sea, what we're really narrowing in on is that if this is a contest over who governs, what that really means is this is a contest over whose laws are enforced. And if you're trying to decide whose laws are enforced in a particular polity or a particular geography over a particular population, this is a question fundamentally, the decisive element is whose laws do the civilians follow. And that is the dynamic that China has thus far very successfully been exploiting in a way that we have not. And this is the reason that that we argue that U.S. strategy in the South China Sea, right now, it's not working, because we are, unlike China, we are not dealing with and seeking to influence this decisive element of what we essentially, and what I'll be referring to in a coming article, as it's a battle of legal regimes. So if we win this battle of legal regimes, that is, frankly, that is what is at the core of every insurgency and counterinsurgency conflict in history, today, worldwide. If we can win the battle of legal regimes, then we can prevail.
I thought in your article that there was a paragraph I thought was particularly interesting. You said, or it was written, despite its expanse and strength, the Chinese government's view of the rules-based international system as a repressive imposition created before the Chinese Communist Party held a seat at the diplomatic table, combined with the dynamics of China's coercive tactics to bend others to its alternate view of governance, makes China in the South China Sea a state-sized insurgent against U.S. liberal world order. What is the Chinese government view of the rules-based international system in terms of the in the context of them being insurgents?
Sure thing. So in this case, when we apply the insurgent and counterinsurgent framework to the South China Sea, essentially what we see is the international system that I would say it's really defined principally in the maritime domain in terms of its adherence to the political, legal, and philosophical principle of the freedom of the sea. That is the prevailing regime that China is essentially rebelling against, where, my wonderful mentor up at the Naval War College, James Holmes, he wrote a few years ago, essentially laying out that China's legal and maritime philosopher, that it is essentially with expansive maritime claims like the nine-dash line that are extra legal, they are outside the recognized scope of burdens like the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. So if the author of the concept of the freedom of the seas is Hugo Grotius, who in the 17th century laid out that the sea should be a global commons open to all. The Chinese view is that essentially this system was written and imposed on the world before the Chinese Communist Party had a seat at the diplomatic table, and essentially they take the opposite view, as I would argue, based on their vantage point as a continental power, that essentially you can own ocean areas just as you can land. And this was an argument that was expressed by a guy named Selden, a British guy. So during the Anglo-Dutch Wars, way back in the 1600s, when the Dutch are essentially trying to break out into the markets of the wider world, in the markets of the East Indies, to be able to conduct trade, they are very much the proponents of the argument of Mare Liberum, the free sea, as espoused by Grotius. And then Selden is a British scholar and thus a partisan in the contracting view that since Britain stands astride the Netherlands sea lines of communications to the outside the North Sea, that essentially maritime sovereignty should go as far as the fleet or shore-based artillery can carry it. So in the end, in that particular argument, following the Anglo-Dutch Wars, the Dutch argument won, and we have been operating for the last several centuries in a world which has, by the way, benefited China enormously over the past 70 years, where the sea is open to all. It is it's a global commons, and for everyone to use, everybody to operate in, navigate in, trade in, and that essentially maritime sovereignty is strictly defined by land-based holdings. It is it's limited to, you've got the 12 nautical miles of territorial waters, another 12 miles of up to 24 nautical miles as your contiguous zone where you can do customs and pollution protection, and then 200 nautical miles out from your low tide baseline is your exclusive economic zone, which is also technically international waters, but you have exclusive rights to resource extraction and other things like that. And then there's the concept of the continental shelf. Essentially, so this structure for adjudicating maritime sovereignty in the world, essentially, China is taking the view that even though if you look at the nine-dash line, parts of it are, you know, over 1,000 miles from China's southernmost coast on Hainan Island. And they say that all of this area, you know, 90% of the South China Sea, is subject to China's indisputable sovereignty. And the way that they are going about articulating and enforcing this is they are imposing their will, which is, you know, codified in their own domestic law, on the civilian maritime populations of other countries, particularly fishing vessels and just other civilian mariners, less commercial traffic that is, you know, passing through, but essentially by imposing their will, through extra legal harassment and threats of force, they are compelling civilians to submit to Chinese dictates, even though they are very much within their rights under the international system. So in this sense, China is an insurgent and is trying to topple the rule of the international system in the South China Sea. Now as we say in the article, they do selectively engage with it, but ultimately, you know, where it suits them, they're perfectly content to operate in the exclusive economic zones of other countries. They conducted innocent passage through the Aleutian Islands. So they're very happy to enjoy the fruits of the international system based on freedom of the sea, where it is convenient. But in places like the South China Sea, they're quite content to refuse the fruits of that to other countries based only on their own power.
Well, I was reading the article you and Pat Cronin put together. What brought to mind was back in 2014 at U.S. Naval Institute West Conference, there was a great panel called What About China? And there was a Captain Stu Belt, JAG. And one of the things that he made a very convincing argument towards was countering China using lawfare. And as often with lawyers, they assume that everybody will follow the law. And if China is going to take this cafeteria approach to international law, where they only take what they want to, is in many regards, you know, 4 years later, if China kind of turned that on us in that they're not so much susceptible to lawfare, but they're using it to their advantage.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that phrase that you used there, the cafeteria approach to international law, really captures it very well. I'm definitely going to use that in a future publication. What the Chinese are doing is they're essentially advancing you're absolutely right. They are advancing an alternative to the current system, the rightful system of international law based on the freedom of the sea. the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, to which they subscribe. And so in practice, even if they may say otherwise, though they have ratified UNCLOS, in practice in the South China Sea, what they are doing is they are essentially, they are, by harassing civilians, and this is really where this is the decisive element of the contest in between these two legal regimes. It's in, do the civilians feel safe? Like, whose laws are the civilians going to follow in practice in their actions day to day? And if essentially if civilians are subject to the continued harassment and threats of force by the China Coast Guard, the Chinese Maritime Militia, the PLA Navy, ultimately, which is backing these other two forces, which do more of the direct interfacing with the civilians. This is not actually a question of really which side would prevail in battle, the United States and its allies or China. It really gets back to whose laws are essentially in force. It's really similar in a way to a situation where you have a dangerous neighborhood and there's a local gang that has said you can't go into a particular store. And even though the local population of that neighborhood is perfectly within their legal rights to go into that store, they're not going to unless they are confident that they will be secure against the reprisals by this local alternative, in many ways, insurgent system of authority of this particular local gang. I mean, FDR talked in the 1930s about international gangsterism when he was talking about the future Axis powers and their aggression against other countries in a much more overt way. I would argue that that FDR's phrase is even more apt today, as essentially China is advancing these particular the manner by which it is advancing its aims, advancing its legal regime in the South China Sea, imposing its will on civilians of its neighbors.
Well, China does argue. I mean, they're trying to use the color of law argument that they have historical right to dominate the South China Sea, that the islands that they're developing. Or actually what were low spots in the water they've developed into islands, are, despite what UNCLOS says, extensions of their sovereign territory. And I think your article points out that the actions or lack of actions taken by the not just the United States but the other countries of the world against those activities on those islands have not been strong enough to stop China from doing what it's doing. Talk a little bit about the lack of enforcement of international law and also the ineffectiveness, I think, as you said earlier, of the freedom of navigation operations carried out by the United States.
Absolutely. So as you very rightly said. So current U.S. strategy in the South China Sea, it's right now the way that it's configured, the way that our operations run, it's actually just not working right now. If you look over the past, what do we say, 10 years, if we consider our core objectives as being to change Chinese behavior and attitude towards international law and to uphold the rule of that international system, our strategy has really failed. And that's in large part because essentially our freedom of navigation operations, where we will go in and we will challenge a particular claim, send a ship or an aircraft to sail or fly through a space where the Chinese are claiming to restrict international transits or make an excessive sovereign claim, will drive through, very similar to it's what the U.S.'s Decatur recently did. A few weeks ago when they were tailed and challenged in a very unprofessional maneuver by the Chinese destroyer Lanzhou. And that's a good way of articulating and demonstrating that the United States does not recognize a particular unlawful claim, sovereign claim. So is in one particular aspect, okay, you know, the Freedom of Navigation operation, as we traditionally understand it, is useful. In the larger frame, these Freedom of Navigation operations, which are kind of the major element of our strategy, they actually don't have any bearing. They're not actually having an impact on the decisive center of gravity in the strategic contest in the South China Sea, in that they are not actively seeking to affect the behavior of local civilian mariners in places, in countries like Vietnam and the Philippines and Malaysia, Indonesia, and Brunei. Because essentially, in America, if with the Freedom of Navigation operation, the American destroyer enters the contested waters, they sail on through for a few hours, and then we leave. We always leave. And the Chinese are very effective in their propaganda, where they will immediately say that whatever ship that they had shadowing ours, they can say that they warned us off. And even though we were always planning to leave, they get something of a PR win when they're able to say, we warned them, we chased them away. And the local civilian onlookers, who they are the ones who will ultimately decide the contest. If we're not sticking around to protect these guys, and they're operating in these contested waters on a far more regular and frequent basis than we do, they're going to watch as essentially if we lack staying power, which our operations currently do, it has no impact because they know that they will have they will be subject to Chinese harassment and intimidation as soon as we leave. And so what essentially we are calling for in terms of a strategy, what maritime counterinsurgency strategy would look like, is something where we actively make it a mission to protect local civilians from Chinese harassment and intimidation as they go about their lawful operations in those areas of the South China Sea as would be permitted under international law. So, and this also gets back to, you mentioned in terms of the Chinese fortification of different maritime features. A lot of our officers are, make very clear that we think that these would be very exposed targets in a shooting war. I remember, I believe, Sal, on a show, I want to say maybe last year, you said that, you're a TLAM strike, you were a TLAM strike officer, you look at those target sets and that's, a pretty good target set for our weapons in terms of those particular fortifications. But essentially, the most important influence that these particular facilities have, it's not in a warfighting environment because they are just such as exposed targets. Their chief value is as logistics hubs and as power projection platforms to intimidate other countries and in particular civilians short of war. And I would really like to give a shout-out to Rupert Wingfield Hayes at the BBC. His reporting on the South China Sea over the past few years has been really exemplary, where he will, some of his stories were, because we don't get the perspective of local civilians, and he went out and he sought it. He got on a Filipino fishing vessel and went out and towards these Chinese fortifications, and he was able to capture how the local civilian mariners were saying, I'm not going close to there because, then the China Coast Guard's going to come over and really be, very threatening. And then when he went up in a little Cessna and flew out to a Philippine-occupied island with an airstrip, P2 Island, and then subsequently tried to convince, civilian aviators to make slightly closer approaches to Chinese fortifications as they were under construction. And again, the Chinese treated them as a foreign military aircraft. And so we're warning them away, and these local civilians were very much intimidated. So if we can change our operation to figure out how we can protect local civilians on a cost-sustainable basis over the long term, however long it takes for the Chinese to abandon their pursuit of this alternative legal regime, to accept the principle of the freedom of the sea that is has been so very good to them, and has been such an important contributor to their prosperity over the last 70 years. If we can, what the next step is, and we're working on mobilizing a community of knowledge to start answering the hard questions as to how a maritime counterinsurgency strategy would work in terms of how do we protect the civilians in a way that does not break the bank, does not overly suck high-end combat forces into low-end presence operations. What is the right mix? What is the right method of deployments? That's where essentially we are very open and receptive to experts in this community, and are very eager for to get people thinking about these hard questions.
I love reading things that cause me to pause and readdress my own assumptions and preconceptions. And that's one of the takeaways that I got from you and Pat's article, and I'm still chewing on it, that had me stop, go back, and I said, I need to read that again, is the question that my co-host just asked you about is the effectiveness of FONOPs. Because I've mentioned in the past or the last few years that, FONOP early and FONOP often, but that's only if you're looking at the power, the utility of the FONOPs from an American perspective and an American force of habits, where we are predominantly a maritime power, and our only national experience and insurgency, I think the last time we did something like that with from an American point of view was in the kind of nasty business that took place in the Kansas and Missouri area during our Civil War, whereas China and Vietnam are traditional land powers, and also in living memory did some very effective and broad range insurgency operations and counterinsurgency operations. And I wonder if part of the problem that we're having of having things go, quote, our, unquote, way in the South China Sea is the fact that we're just not looking at it well from a Chinese perspective, and what the Chinese are doing and what their concept of operations are to achieve, because they're using tools and ideas that intellectually we just haven't gotten hold of yet.
Yeah, I think the issue of you're absolutely right. I think questions of strategic culture are very pertinent here. And this is something that I had the good fortune of taking a counterinsurgency seminar with Dr. Colin Jackson, who until recently ran the Advanced Strategist Program at the Naval War College and is now Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Central Asia. And one of the issues we address is that strategic cultures really do matter. And you look at particularly the difference in the experience, or the counterinsurgency experience of folks like the British in places like Yemen and Oman versus Britain has a very long history of rebellion sponsorship, often successfully. I ended up right as part of that, digging into the experience of T.E. Lawrence and British rebellion sponsorship in the Hejaz and Arabia during the First World War. And the U.S., certainly, our recent counterinsurgency experiences have been kind of difficult. Ultimately, I think we're starting to get our head around how do we do this more effectively, as we're now shifting towards essentially need to return to great power competition. In terms of U.S. experience as an insurgent, I definitely agree. Really, our last experience is bleeding Kansas, and then you could make an argument that Reconstruction was an exercise in insurgency and counterinsurgency. If we go farther back, the American Revolution is definitely, and the Seven Years' War too, are definitely potentially fruitful. One area where I'm currently planning out next project at some point is going to be what George Washington's experience as a very young officer in the Virginia militia during the Seven Years' War and French and Indian War, what that can teach us about the South China Sea. Because if you look at what he was dealing with, here was a French, essentially the French were engaged in a kind of, it was, I would say it's less explicitly insurgency and counterinsurgency because it was lacking the element that I would argue is critical to that particular form of warfare. But they're very much engaged in what we now refer to as gray zone aggression, building forts down the Mississippi Valley, south from Canada. And you look at George Washington's first mission into the frontier, and it's to deliver a letter to a French the commander of a French fortification saying that, you know, they need to get out of the Ohio country. And then subsequently, his first real command assignment, where he it does not go his way at the Battle of Fort Necessity, that's very much in, if not counterinsurgency, counter-gray zone operations. And then in the maritime sphere, what I've been very excited to find, one of the aspects that really was a major influence on me as I was first kind of coming up with this, maritime insurgency and maritime counterinsurgency, I'd say it's really been the confluence of several different threads and lines of thinking that I've been working on for the past several years. And one of them has actually been my work on the Asiatic Fleet, which we discussed the warfighting component of in my last appearance on this show, which was great fun. More recently, I've been digging into the Asiatic Fleet's peacetime experience, particularly in the period between 1937 and 1940, which is a really interesting period of time where the Asiatic Fleet was engaged in what we would now probably refer to, and as I refer to it in a forthcoming piece for the Naval War College Review, as its gray zone deterrence against the Japanese gray zone aggression against U.S. and other Western interests in China during Imperial Japan's invasion of China in the Second Sino-Japanese War. And essentially, Imperial Japan is not interested in going to war explicitly with the United States and Great Britain at that period of time. But they do seek to achieve a revisionist objective of throwing U.S. and Western interests, political, economic, diplomatic interests, out of China. And the international law situation there was actually quite internationally, globally, the international legal system that we know of today was less developed. In China, it was actually much more explicitly laid out, and there was an explicit guaranteed right of freedom of navigation on Chinese rivers. And the Asiatic Fleet is faced with the challenge as very much the inferior force, quantitatively and qualitatively in smaller and less well-equipped forward-deployed naval force in the Western Pacific. How do you defend American interests against this really insidious form of aggression? And what I found in my research is that the Asiatic Fleet was actually reasonably successful, despite its limited resources, at protecting American American interests in the region for the duration that it adopted this very forward-leaning posture under the command of Admiral Harry Yarnell to protect American interests wherever they were for as long as necessary. And Washington was initially, not particularly excited about this strategy because, they're dealing with a political environment where isolationism is very strong domestically, and they're not looking to get involved in any kind of entangling intervention. And Harry Yarnell is much more, willing to be, move his forces forward in to counter gray zone aggression at the point of attack. Really harnessing strategies of what we would now refer to as deterrence by denial rather than deterrence by punishment. And so that's actually a case study that is where we were actually pretty successful on the counter gray zone side. Again, there wasn't so much the whose laws do the civilians follow question as much as it was simply gray zone aggression. And then in terms of the counterinsurgency episode, another one that I would point to that we can refer to in our own strategic canon is actually that of the U.S. Marines in Vietnam, where unlike the Army, which was focused on large unit sweeps and, you know, search and destroy maneuvers with, you know, lots of tanks and infantry massed and moving through areas where the Viet Cong was believed to be basing. And those large unit sweeps were relatively ineffective at, you know, both at, you know, searching and destroying, you know, enemy forces, and also at, you know, actually, you know, having a strategic impact on the wider war. What the Marines did was they really got down to this question, which was very much at work with the Viet Cong, of, you know, whose laws are enforced, whose laws do you follow, where essentially they're deployed in the southern part of South Vietnam, and the Viet Cong has a very heavy presence there. And what the VC is doing is they say, okay, they will go to the civilians and they will say, okay, you're going to pay your taxes to us and not the government. And, you know, we are the political authority here. And because there's no one there to protect the civilians, they've been compelled to comply. It's not a question of hearts and minds. It's really a matter of control. It gets back to, you know, J.C. Wiley and his theory of power control. And what the Marines do is they break into small units, combined arms platoon, and they move into these different villages, and they go to the civilians and they say, okay, don't pay your taxes to the VC. When they come to collect, we will protect you. And sure enough, the VC, they come to, you know, they come to collect their taxes the next time around. They find out that the civilians aren't willing to pay, and they come to attack the village. The Marines beat them back. The VC returns with ever larger formations, eventually up to battalion-sized forces, and the Marines are able to defeat them. And ultimately, with the their hold on the civilian population broken, the Viet Cong abandons the area. And this is really well laid out in Andrew Krepinevich's book on the Army in Vietnam. And that's another very good example of an area of the strategic of the U.S. strategic canon that we could really be applying to these current situations. And then there's more recent examples like, you know, H.R. McMaster in Talifar and other examples in, you know, the Iraq and Afghanistan situations where people have a lot more a lot of people today have, you know, very direct experience.
Yeah, as I'm reading the article and I'm thinking to myself, you know, your solution, part of the solution, is to forward deploy more U.S. ships and assets to help the populations in the surrounding countries not be harassed or defend them from being harassed by Chinese forces. And you've already hit on one key phrase. One is staying power, and the other is the overcoming the proximity of the Chinese forces compared to our forces. We don't have any bases in Philippines like we did when I was a young officer. We have some relationships with people in Singapore and some other, you know, and Japan. But, you know, I think if we get more involved with Taiwan or the Philippines, I mean, there are some real issues here on the size of the fleet we would need to become a policeman to protect third party nations from what China is doing. How do you view that as a solution? Do we need a larger fleet? Do we need to be more aggressive using the fleet we have? How do we overcome the proximity of China and the need to have staying power?
That's a really great question, and that is a definite focus of, you know, where in terms of the thinking on maritime counterinsurgency needs to be moving next. And that's where, you know, really engaging the community of knowledge who are already working in this space is going to be really important. I think in terms of the question of do we need a larger fleet, do we need to be more aggressive with the fleet we have, I think, you know, the answer is both, absolutely. We definitely need more forward presence, and we need more forces to actually do this. definitely at the lower end. You know, we've essentially decommissioned all of our frigates with the decommissioning of the Perry class, and which was previously essentially neutered when we took off their missile launchers last decade. At least, you know, neutered in terms of a high-end threat environment. And then, so you know, definitely programs like LCS platforms will likely be, you know, very helpful in this kind of environment. The forthcoming, you know, the future frigate is going to be definitely very important. And then I think we also need to be thinking creatively. How do we actually expand our maritime presence? How, you know, expand in terms of not necessarily looking for combat power as much as it is just simple physical presence that is going to be, you know, by flying the flag of the United States, vessels will be subject to potentially more protection because essentially, you know, they're flying the flag of, you know, the world's leading nuclear power. That, you know, that will give us potentially greater freedom of action and, you know, greater staying power and, you know, able and the ability to protect civilians where they are, you know, more affordably. And, you know, part of it's going to be engaging with partners, but part of it I think is really going to be about, okay, how do we get some cheap, well-built hulls in the water? And, you know, we look, you know, again, looking to history, when we are faced with a protection of shipping challenge like we are today, I mean, in this case, it's not commercial shipping quite as much, it's really going to be about, you know, hulls in the water, things like, you know, concepts like armed trawlers, armed tugboats might be, you know, really helpful to think about bringing back or expanding. And that'll be something that, you know, even relatively, you know, material-poor partner countries like the Philippines, like Malaysia, countries that don't really have high-end warfighting naval forces, this is something where they can engage really effectively. And we have in our you know, treaty alliance, you know, our coalition of treaty allies in East Asia, you know, Japan and South Korea, or South Korea and Japan, I should say, are the first and third largest shipbuilders in the world, respectively. So they can play a really important role in building, you know, physically building this kind of, you know, robust maritime presence for ourselves and our partners at the very low end, where we're not looking at trying to put a lot of missile launchers on this. Potentially might, but and then, you know, platforms that are, you know, currently entering the U.S. inventory today, like, you know, the Mark VI patrol boat, is something that is a, you know, that's a platform that can be very easily forward deployed to places like Palawan and Luzon, that and Vietnam, you know the former U.S. base at Cam Ranh Bay. These are which can certainly host you know, bigger platforms. The Philippines have a base at Oyster Bay in Palawan for, you know, small, you know, relatively small low-end patrol forces. And there are lots, and part of my work as a fellow at the Naval War College has been focused on, you know, where are, you know, the good harbors in this region, and there's luckily plenty of them, and that means that we can be very expeditionary. And, you know, looking to create advanced bases. This is thinking that we've done before. As we were prepping for War Plan Orange in the 1930s, there was a lot of smart thinking about how do we kind of work in a very kind of nimble and agile way. And in this case, hopefully, and, you know, the plan is certainly that, you know, this will remain short of war. And this is, a, you know, obviously an essential warfighting ability to you know, have agile logistics and agile forward basing. So certainly these kinds of capabilities will be really important. And then there's in terms of, I would just also like to add that a maritime counterinsurgency strategy, you know, you mentioned, you know, very aptly that China's, you know, they're just closer. They are way closer to this problem than we are, or our, you know, principal Northeast Asian partners. They're right there, and therefore they're going to have an enduring advantage here. And I would say that maritime counterinsurgency is actually not aimed at changing the overall military balance in the region. There are a lot of other things that we can do that. I think the Dr. Holmes and Dr. Krepinevich have written, a great deal about, defending the first island chain using land-based forces, and then keeping the fleet more offshore as a counter-concentration and maneuver force. So in terms of thinking about warfighting contingencies, that's probably more the way to go. But at the same time, it gets – what the Chinese have been very effective at doing is, getting back to the issue of strategic cannons, they are really following the dictates of – and the recommendations of Sun Tzu. And, his – I would say the overall message that you can – that, from the Art of War is that if you – it is always better to get – to achieve your objectives without having to fight. And if we get too overly focused on building up battle force capability at the expense of maritime presence and operations that are aimed at ensuring that we're achieving our political objectives in peacetime as well as in wartime, we actually all of those efforts in terms of preparing for a high intensity contingency will kind of come to naught because they will have gotten what they want. And achieve their objectives without having to fight us at all. And we will be the weaker, and this will be at our expense. So we need to be thinking about how do we think competitively? How do we work in this, maritime counterinsurgency situation short of, kinetic confrontation? How do we protect civilians without actually having to fight? Because if we can figure out what the Chinese have done is they have made our high-end combat forces, greatest navy in the world, that they have made us irrelevant in these peacetime or subkinetic environments. And what we need to be thinking about with a maritime counterinsurgency strategy is how do we make them irrelevant? They've put a lot of effort into building up their navy, their maritime law enforcement, their maritime militia, these fortified maritime features in the Spratlys and the Dangerous Ground. That takes a lot of money and a lot of treasure. So if we can keep them from achieving their political objectives without fighting, if we can achieve our political objectives without fighting, then all of that effort on their part, they've sunk a lot of time and energy into. If we can render them irrelevant, that's an outcome that I would really like to see.
Yeah, to paraphrase a book written by a former U.S. president, part of this, in many ways, is the audacity of ambiguity. Is you mentioned Sun Tzu, but I think you can make a connection here. You take a little bit of Sun Tzu and a little bit of Putin, and I think you can trace a line to what we're looking at now to the signal the international community sent in response to Russia's little green men in Crimea, where they were actions short of war. Nobody wanted to go to war, but in many ways, the West believes in its international order, in its international law, in its international norms. And they talk about backing that up with hard power. But what if you don't think they'll actually do it, but you don't want to push things so far that you force a hand that doesn't want to be played anyway? And I think the Russians did a masterful job in Crimea with their little green men. And we've also seen the expansion of what some people have referred to, I believe, as China's Third Navy, with their maritime militia and other actions in the Third World, in the South China Sea. And in some regards, do you see that connection where the Chinese sense weakness that they can take advantage of without really doing anything or putting the forces out there that might provoke somebody to play a hand they don't want to play?
I absolutely agree. Another great Commander Salamander phrase of the audacity of ambiguity. That is really what is at play here. And you're absolutely right in terms of the sense that essentially the West certainly, nobody wants to go to war. And when essentially you've created a situation for yourself where that is your primary option in terms of if you want to stop aggression, well, that's potentially something that you know, actors like Putin, actors like Xi Jinping, can take advantage of, and you know, and again, at our expense. And so essentially, you know, absolutely, the maritime militia and the little green men are, you know, very much in the in a similar thought space of essentially creating an ambiguous situation, reducing state-level accountability for aggressive revisionist actions. Frankly, we're seeing it in Syria. The detachment that our forces destroyed with artillery and air power in the spring, I want to say in March of 2018, was a Russian. It was technically not a state force. It was a mercenary organization equipped with T-72s that was advancing against. It was advancing in essentially a probing action against U.S. and U.S.-backed forces in Syria, and the U.S. met that probing action with overwhelming firepower, which after we established that the Russians were not taking accountability for the actions of that force, they said those are not our people, and he said, "Great, take it out." So I think Mattis told Joe Dunford that he directed for that force to be quote unquote annihilated. And it, you know, and it very largely was. I'm not saying that we need to be going and blowing people out of the water in the South China Sea necessarily. Definitely, it is these situations of ambiguity. You know, getting back to this concept of gray zone aggression, that is an ambiguity that our adversaries are taking advantage of, and we need to be looking for opportunities to take advantage of as well. Frankly, you know, you look at getting back to the Asiatic Fleet case study in the 1930s. Imperial Japan very consciously chose not to declare war against China until eventually it happened anyway as a result of, you know, with the attack on Pearl Harbor, they declared war against the United States as well as against China and Britain and so forth. But in this situation where Imperial Japan was conducting a full-scale war, engaging, you know, a very significant percentage of their merchant shipping in logistics support, and you know, hundreds of thousands, you know, millions of men in the field, this continued to be referred to by Japan and Western commentators as the Sino-Japanese incident. You know, quote unquote incident. Not, you know, this is the second Sino-Japanese war. It was something below that, and that had implications that the U.S. Asiatic Fleet was able to take advantage of, because all of a sudden the Japanese were trying to declare a blockade. They couldn't enforce it on neutral shipping because they were not claiming for themselves belligerent rights, because there were international political implications in terms of the cost and political capital of declaring war in violation of, in many ways, actually the Kellogg-Briand Pact, and that, you know, essentially stigmatizing that particular recourse of, you know, declaring war, and all of a sudden new rules are enforced. Well, certainly the Asiatic Fleet was trying to respect, you know, the Imperial Japanese Navy as a peer rival, a, you know, peer service, you know, peer professionals. The ambiguity, which worked in Japan's favor, where they would try and, you know, potentially make a move towards occupying a major international settlement, for example, or taking over some other Western interest or besieging Western consulates. The ambiguity, which worked in their favor, the Asiatic Fleet was also able to use to some degree in its favor. And so working in this ambiguity, getting comfortable with gray, this is something that will be really important, certainly in a maritime counterinsurgency strategy in the South China Sea. It will be important. It continues to be important in situations with respect to Putin's Russia. And so, absolutely, if we can get comfortable with using ambiguity to our advantage and not simply allowing, you know, remaining tethered to constructs and, you know, methods of operations which aren't working in our favor, like I would argue an over-reliance on traditional freedom of navigation operations. If we can find a way to retool our operations towards essentially being more effective in these ambiguous situations so as to achieve our political objectives without fighting, without at the same time provoking an armed response, that will be, I think, very important.
Well, I'm not a big fan of ignoring ambiguity or trying to play along those lines. Sometimes you have to draw a line in the sand. And my question is, what price is China paying, if any, for this belligerence, this aggressive approach to things? And why are we not adopting some of the – if it is an insurgency, the Joint Pub 3-24 and counterinsurgency says an effective coin operation will utilize all instruments of national power to integrate and synchronize political, security, legal, economic development, and psychological activities. You know, China is dependent on the sea for its fuel, for for export of its goods. Does it do any good to say, look, you know, if you continue this path, and call it a spade, we can clamp down on you pretty hard if we want to. And you've taken advantage of you've used the international law system to your advantage. You can't have it both ways. You've got to stop this kind of aggression. Or is that just too black and white for the modern world?
I think there is definitely a line, you know, hidden in the gray. There is definitely a line that we need, and there are lines where we can – can and should be firmly saying, you know, don't cross this line. And we need to be developing options where that will allow us to enforce that line, and be prepared, you know, obviously if necessary, to conduct combat operations, but to really, you know, be able to achieve our political objectives again without fighting. And so definitely. As you said, China is in a really bad geographical position in terms of its maritime geography. It is hemmed in anywhere it turns by First Island Chain, you know, the entirety of which is controlled by U.S. Allies or, you know, strategic partners. And so essentially, and as you mentioned, in terms of their oil needs, China imports 60% of its oil needs. 93% of these come by sea, and 84%, at least in 2014, entered the South China Sea or entered the First Island Chain through the South China Sea via the Strait of Malacca. So the degree to which I think, you know, certainly getting back to Alfred Thayer Mahan, you know, he made the, you know, very astute point that a blockade is very much an act of war. But there are definitely options where we can potentially squeeze them and find ways of, you know, enforcing greater compliance with, you know, more of a deterrence by punishment strategy. But I think the key thing is, I would argue we risk over-reliance on deterrence by punishment, whether that's through economic sanctions, whether that's through, you know, higher-end combat powers or, you know, and so forth. If we were to overly choose, you know, a deterrence by punishment strategy over at the expense of deterrence by denial, I think we do that at our peril. Because essentially, you know, deterrence by denial, which is, you know, very much what the Asiatic fleet is doing in the 1930s and was very successful at doing, of, you know, interposing itself physically and being there at the scene where essentially an adversary is trying to make a move. That is a really important – making it that much harder for the adversary to actually carry through its objectives rather than threaten reprisal. The problem with the deterrence by punishment strategy is if, you know, what if they call our bluff? It's not that, you know, deterrence by punishment strategies aren't always effective or aren't sometimes effective. But, you know, they need to be part of a larger, you know, as you said, in integrating all elements of national power – with, you know, as, you know, 3-24 absolutely says, if we can find a way to, you know, we need to be looking for options and opportunities to engage on a broader level in a counterinsurgency framework that I would argue will be much more successful. Because, you know, our strategy thus far, it has failed, but our failure thus far is not final. And just because the Chinese have been winning thus far, it doesn't mean we can't still turn it around. So really what I would say we need to do, and what, you know, the recent article, you know, seeks to be, start the process of doing, is back up, start from the beginning, look at what are the key elements that are in play here, what are the key centers of gravity, what are the decisive strategic dynamics that we need to be having an impact on, and then work from there. What instruments are at are available to have decisive impact so we can achieve our political diplomatic objectives and in a more effective way.
Well, Hunter, that's man, what a fast hour. Really appreciate you coming on this afternoon, and I'm glad that we stuck with just the South China Sea topic because I know my co-host is probably the same boat I am. We all have a few more questions to ask, but you mentioned a couple of things that you're going to be working on in the future. So if you could, just to wind things up, what can the listener look forward to for additional writing you have coming down the road? And besides Twitter, at Hunter Stiers, where else could the listener follow your work?
Well, first off, thank you so much for a fantastic hour. I definitely agree. It went by really quickly. So in terms of future work, my piece in the Naval War College Review is forthcoming and is currently scheduled for the summer 2019 issue of that publication. And that will cover the Asiatic Fleet's experience conducting grades on deterrence operations against Imperial Japan during the Second Sino-Japanese War between 1937 and 1940. I continue to write for the National Interest. I'm currently queuing up a second article for either TNI or elsewhere on maritime counterinsurgency, seeking to kind of expand on the theoretical foundations of the concept of, you know, the battle of legal regimes and how that kind of direction. And then in the future, we'll also be looking at seeking to write about more operationally focused questions of, okay, what exactly is a maritime counterinsurgency strategy going to look like in implementation at the tactical and operational level? And what lessons can we draw from, whether we're looking at, you know, the British experience in the Cod Wars or the Asiatic Fleet? Or how do we translate the Marine Corps' experience in South Vietnam with the combined actions platoons into a maritime context? So all of these things of, you know, getting down into the details, work continues, and we're definitely looking forward to that.
Well, perfect. Really appreciate it, Hunter, and hope you have a great fall.
Thank you. You too. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Hunter. You guys have raised a lot of interesting questions in your article, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for joining us for another edition of Midrats. Make sure and tune in next week when our guest will be Michael Jung to discuss his book, Crimes of Command. And the week after that, our guest will be Craig Whiteside with a Long War update. Hope everybody has a great fall and have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me.